said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now. I said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now.
So long I've been waiting, waiting for you. Oh yeah. Now the time has come when it's between me and you.
That's right. It's time for the 5 o'clock train every Thursday from 5 to 6. I'm your host, Anita Onkour, and today we have a very special interview with Derek Jensen, author of Endgame, environmental activist. This will be a call-in interview all the way from California. So I'm going to put some music on to give us some time to get the technical side of the phone connection set up. And I'm going to play, a little bit from this album by Mzwakhe Mbuli. And the song is called Many Years Ago. So enjoy this while we set up the technical side of the show.
Like a lion in the jungle, trees bowed down their leaves in honor of true humanity. From time immemorial, the wind blew sedulously in the churches, many times over in the land of Patrice Lumumba. Designed the golden beauties of this world, like the aborigines in their land of origin. This was ancient life in the prodigious times. A built-in shock proof was internally in men. This was the quality of tradition before the ship wrecked into the sea of sorrow. Decades ago, decades are past. The altars of calamity dimmed and darkened cardinal ways of life, paralyzing laughter in the face of men. Men that have none to crack. This is how I lost the smile many times over in the land of Titanic Kimati. Foreign cultures took over my culture. Invaders killed men, but the soul failed to die. As surface tormented men, but the spirit failed to surrender. Remember, this is where it all started. Despotism and feudalism against men. Many, many years ago, men turned both cheeks in response to global salute. This is how I lost my land. Tragically, the wagon of our culture was bombed, torpedoed beyond human cruelty. Men murdered like men maimed in Hiroshima. Personal ambition is holocaust, when men will sail men at the expense of his blood. Go tell it in the mountains, Biafra and Katanga is no more. No more is the Somoza family, the victims of circumstances. The affiliation of men to justice reigns ever, against the incorrigible planners of perjury, defining man's status to boy. Alpha is not the omega, the tradition of non-surrender is the name of the game. To a people's republic, the tradition of no surrender is the name of the game. To a people's government.
Birdman Sound, CHUO 89.1 and CKCU 93.1 FM present The Dirt Bomb with Kelly Stoltz. Tuesday, April 15th at Babylon Nightclub. The Dirt Bombs have reinvented themselves with their new record, We Have You Surrounded. Their live set is infectious and sure to blow you away. Kelly Stoltz will start the night off with some 70s-influenced feel-good tunes. That's The Dirt Bombs and Kelly Stoltz, Tuesday, April 15th at Babylon Nightclub, 317 Bank Street. Advance tickets are $15 and available at Birdman Sound. Don't miss out on the show of the year.
Okay, we're back on the air, and hopefully Derek Jensen is on the phone with us. Are you there, Derek?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. I'm good, and we're starting a full hour of interview on your work and discussions about activism and so on. Maybe you could start by just giving us an overview of some of your key books and, in a very short nutshell, what each one is about. Is that a good place to start?
Sure. The book that sort of made my work a little bit more well-known was A Language Older Than Words, and that book really is about... that uses the lens of domestic violence to look at the larger violence of the culture. And then that was followed by Culture Make-Believe, which, started off being a five-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups, but I asked the question, what is hate? And it ended up exploding and really becoming a book about the necessary relationship between this culture's economic system and atrocity and how it leads inevitably to atrocity. And then there's...
You say it exploded. How many pages was that book?
Oh, 650 or something.
Oh, so we're talking big, thick bricks here.
Yeah. And then there was Welcome to the Machine, which is about surveillance, and Walking on Water, which is about education. It has one of my favorite first lines of a book I've written, which is, the first two lines, which are, as is true for most people I know, I've always loved learning. As is also true for most people I know, I always hated school. Why is that? And Strangely Like Wars about Deforestation, Endgame came next, and that really, sort of language, culture, and Endgame kind of form an informal trilogy. That language would be, how do you make yourself sane in the crazy culture? Culture would be about, okay, once you're at least semi-sane, when you look around, what do you see? And Endgame is, what are you going to do about it? Endgame is based on the idea, based on the question, really, do you believe the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And everybody asks, says no. And if you don't believe it's going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and your tactics? And the answer is, we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. One of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. It's all this sort of magical thinking stuff. And it's, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about the fact that this culture is killing the planet? And then since then, I've had a couple more books come out. One of them is called Thought to Exist in the Wild, Awakening from the Nightmare of Zoos. And that's a... I wrote the essay, about 120-page essay or something, and there's these amazing photographs by Karen Tweedy Holmes, and it's an anti-zoo book, obviously. And then the other one is As the World Burns, which I wrote with the great graphic artist Stephanie McMillan. She does Minimum Security, and that's a graphic novel about... it starts off sort of a spoof of the solutions presented, you know, 50 Simple Ways You Can Save the Earth. The book is called As the World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. And we did the math on how all the so-called solutions presented by Al Gore and his movie to global warming, and if everybody in the United States did them, it would cut, I think, like 21% or 22% off of carbon emissions. That's what every single person in the United States did them. And, of course, that's grossly insufficient. And since he doesn't disbelieve in the growth economy, it would all disappear again in a few years of economic growth. And then the book takes off from there, and it has these space aliens who, one of their waste products is gold, and they come down and give the president lots of gold, so he gives them permits to basically consume the world. And since they have permits, you can't stop them because it's all legal now, isn't it? And so it's you know, just sort of, and then the corporations...
Doesn't sound like a fantasy at all.
Yeah, I know. And the corporations then get really upset because aliens aren't supposed to consume the planet, corporations are.
Right.
So there's a big sort of...
Competition
between them, and meanwhile, most everybody is just sort of frozen in place, but then two little girls and a... one-eyed rabbit start fighting back, and it goes on from there. It's
well,
really
if you've got a one-eyed rabbit on your side, your chances are good.
Yeah, I really think so.
Yeah.
A one-eyed rabbit named Bonista.
Listen, the end game is actually a two-volume book, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
And with a total number of pages, which is what?
I don't know, 1,100, something like that.
Right, 1,100 pages. So you really got a chance there to tell your story about what are we going to do about it, right?
Yeah, one of the things I'm pretty known for better or worse, is, or one of the things, I should say this, one of the things I'm really trying to do with a lot of my work is, I'm trying to destroy the hegemony of linear thought, and, because I think that linear thinking is one of the problems. We don't need to really go there extensively, but it's one of the problems.
It isn't an example of that. If we all just do a little in the right direction, then that'll be enough eventually to push everything in the right direction, and we'll have a sane world all of a sudden. Is that linear thinking?
That would be one example. Another example would be that if I can't with perfect certainty. And basically, the, sort of at the heart of a lot of linear thinking is the notion that we can truly understand cause and effect. And I'm not saying that we can't understand some basic cause and effects. I mean, I just picked up a pencil and now I dropped the pencil, and it fell to the ground. So we can presume that if I drop a pencil, it's going to fall. There's a sort of straightforward cause and effect there. But there's this massive hubris that suggests that you can remove passenger pigeons from a forest and have any sort of remote prediction on what the effects are going to be, or you can move salmon from a forest, or, and a great example actually is my own guts, that I have Crohn's disease, which is a incurable, progressive, horrible disease, which is a disease of civilization that gives me sores anywhere from my lips down to my anus. I get sores all over my intestines, diarrhea. And one of the causes that they figured out recently is that they realize that people in non-industrialized nations don't get Crohn's disease and as much.
Is that because they don't live long enough to get it? I mean, is it something you get when you're older?
Oh, no, most people get it when they're in their 20s. My growth spurt was late. I should have got it when I was. I got it, but not diagnosed when I was a kid.
All right.
And even when you account for the fact that a lot of people in a non-industrialized nation might die of dysentery,
mm-hmm.
or they might be diagnosed as dysentery, but they actually had Crohn's disease.
Right.
Even when you account for all that, it still is really a one-to-one correspondence. If the country industrializes, then Crohn's disease goes up.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought maybe it's because of industrialized diets, or maybe it's because of pollution. What they finally figured out is, and they don't know this for sure, but there's a very, very good chance that it's because of an absence of a certain sort of parasite in my guts.
Uh-huh.
But about a billion people on the planet have what are called whipworms or helminths, infestations of these.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to think for a while that maybe, I would have a hyperactive immune system, and if I don't attack the worms, I attack myself. But it ends up that's not really the case. It ends up that the worms, the people who have helminths, actually don't have, for the most part, Crohn's disease. For the most part, they don't have multiple sclerosis, and for the most part, they don't have certain types of arthritis, and for the most part, they don't have asthma.
Right.
And it ends up that the worms actually modulate your immune system. And my point in bringing all this up is that, so I actually take worms, and they're helping me a lot. And
you take live worms? I mean, do you give yourself parasites?
Yeah, I take eggs.
Okay.
And actually, they're pig whipworms, and the reason they do that is because if I took human whipworms and then they, for whatever reason, didn't help me, then I would end up with not only Crohn's, but also infestation of whipworms.
Right, which are difficult to get rid of?
I don't know.
Okay.
I do know that they attach to your lining your intestine, can cause you to bleed and all sorts of other stuff. So,
right.
So with somebody who's already bleeding anyway, that wouldn't be a good thing, generally.
Okay.
The point is that it's hard for me to tell, even though I am intimate with this disease. I've had this disease basically forever, and I can't tell what causes one flare-up or not. Is it because I didn't get enough sleep? Is it because I ate something wrong? Is it because of something in my life? Is it because the disease decided to suddenly go wrong? It's not a linear relationship. I can't say. I can't say I generally feel better when I'm having a flare-up. I generally feel better if I eat more meat and less fiber. Fiber generally makes me more uncomfortable. But I have friends with Crohn's disease who, when they get Crohn's, they go eat a salad.
Okay.
And my point is that...
But wait, before you go on with this, are you personally convinced that the worms help you with this disease?
Oh, I'm not convinced. I have experienced it.
So you have a conviction based on your experience. That's what I mean.
On my direct personal experience, yes.
Yes. So you're confident of that conclusion for yourself.
I don't know why. I do know. See, a couple years ago, 3 years ago, I guess, Crohn's almost killed me. It's almost killed me a couple times.
Uh-huh.
And one of the times, about 3 years ago, I was losing about a pound and a half a day. And what saved my life at that point was this high-tech, genetically modified infusion. And that saved my life, but it didn't make me any better. And I'm just sort of, I'm not losing weight anymore, but I'm not gaining weight. I'm about 40 pounds underweight, and I'm just sort of limping along that way. And I start taking the worms. I'm supposed to kick in about 2 months later, but about a month and a half after starting to take the worms, I start dreaming again, and I start writing again, and I start feeling a lot better. So, there we go. There's the question. Causality? I mean, that could be. Could it be
right.
If the disease decided to say, hey, you know, I think I've done enough now. I want to go back to sleep for a while. Or was it because of the worms? Or was it because of the combo, the worms? And see, that's my point on linear thinking.
So these worms are like a dose. Eventually, your metabolism kills them, but you take them when you feel that you need them. Is that the idea?
I take them every couple weeks or every month. I should take them every couple weeks, but I take them every month because they're pretty expensive.
Okay, but you have to keep taking them because your metabolism does kill them. Is that the idea?
Well, what happens is because they're pig whipworms, they're not able to attach.
Uh-huh.
But the baby worms, and I feel sort of bad about it. I actually feel quite bad about it. The baby worms, they try to attach, and they are able to modulate my immune system, but then they get defecated out because they are not able to attach because they're on the wrong animal.
Right. I see.
And I felt really bad about that at first until...
You're just using them.
Yeah. Well, and I talked to my doctor about that, and he said, do you eat meat? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, consider them food then. Because that actually made me feel a little bit better. Because, you know, it's like if I eat any meat, and same is true of the carrot. You know, I eat a carrot, it's killing the carrot.
Right.
So that doesn't alter the fact that the little worms are doing me a favor, and I'm not doing them any favors back.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, back to the original point.
Well, there are more of them in the world because humans use them in this way.
Well, that's true. And there's also there actually are whipworms are not in trouble at all. Whipworms.
Okay.
There's about a billion people, human whipworms.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's the same for pig whipworms. Human whipworms, about a billion people on the planet who have whipworm infestation.
Right.
And it used to be almost everybody. In the United States Southeast, as of the 1930s, it was essentially 100% rate of infestation.
Right.
Anyway, so my point back to the original thing is that linear thinking would say, you know, worms good. But we can't tell. It's, you know, in the real world, cause and effect, I'm not saying that cause and effect doesn't exist, but cause and effect gets really, really hard to point at one cause for one effect.
Sure. I mean, with complex phenomena, you can see a correlation, but that doesn't imply a relation of cause and effect. That's your point, I think, right?
That's a lot of my point. And as it relates to the larger culture, one of the things that this culture does is systematically attempt to, well, I call it either selective intelligence or selective stupidity. And one of the ways I see this is that economists, you know, they'll talk about how a downturn in the Japanese housing market will affect, you know, U.S. wood supply or something.
Right.
And they see the linkages there very, very clearly. But when it comes to the natural world, suddenly they get really stupid and they pretend there's no relationship between pesticides, collapse of chickadee populations, and the growth of forests. And that's actually a direct one, by the way, that it ends up that there have been some studies done that show that trees grow, I think, I'm making up the number, but it's like 40% or 60% faster with the presence of chickadees because they eat insects.
Right.
But people become... People who are running this culture become selectively stupid on those things, of course.
You could also argue that the economists themselves are stupid and they're only pointing out correlations as part of serving power. I mean, they're service intellectuals who are playing this role to serve power. You could argue that about economists.
Oh, I would totally agree with you. I would argue the same for a lot of scientists. I would argue the same for most ists of any sort.
Right.
It's like there's a great one. I was talking to my agent yesterday. His name is Anthony Arnov, and he's great. He's a really good activist, and I really like him for any number of reasons. And he was complaining about he just participated in the Winter Soldier stuff going on, and he was complaining or just commenting really on the lack of mainstream media coverage. And just laughing about it, really, because it's so expected. And there's a great line by Henry Adams that I think about every time anything like this comes up, which is, the press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. And we can say the same thing for a lot of academia. We can say the same thing for a lot of scientists, engineers.
I mean, you don't even have to put the word a lot of in front there. I think it's a fair generalization to just leave out the a lot of.
Well, thank you, and I agree. I was hedging a little bit because I don't know you very well yet. I would totally agree with that.
Uh-huh.
And we could say, okay, let's be really precise. Would we say, I guess what the precise thing would be with a very few exceptions? Because there are some exceptions. But
there are always exceptions that prove the rule.
Yeah, okay, so we can just say it. Okay.
Good. I think so. I think we'll just say it. That's where I would go.
Good.
This is great. Listen, your book, Walking on Water, was about education, and I happen to be an educator, so I want to go there for a little bit.
Great.
One of the things I've discovered recently is when I'm giving classes, one of the most important things I do is I remove the power relationship with the students by removing the fact that I grade them. So I take away grades, and I don't have that control over them. Is that an element that you explored in your book?
Absolutely. And when I used to teach both at, both at Eastern Washington University and then at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, at the prison, we didn't give grades. And
why not? Why is that obvious?
Because it was an ongoing class. It wasn't. It was actually what a class is supposed to be, as opposed to somebody getting credit. The only reason that students came is because they wanted to learn, and they would. And I had students for. I taught for maybe 4 or 5 years, and I had some students. I went for the whole 4 or 5 years. It was ongoing every week, or every other week, or, I mean, depending on if they were locked down. But there was no beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
Which is another problem, of course, with classes.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Eastern, the way I dealt with that is it was a writing class, and of course it struck me as, immoral to ask my students to write from the heart and then to give them a grade. You know, this is a wonderful and moving portrayal of your, you know, recovery from sexual abuse as a child, but I have to say that you used 4 comma splices, so you get a C. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And so I was required by the department to give grades, and what we came up with that worked pretty well in that circumstance was that every time they wrote something, they would get a check mark. And if they rewrote it, they would get a check mark. And if they took it to what they and I call doneness, that's, you know, really go over it line by line a bunch of times, get it until every word you're happy with, then they would get 3 more check marks. And if they did something they'd never done before, like if somebody who loves rock and roll went to a classical concert, or if somebody who's never been to a Chinese restaurant, went to a Chinese restaurant. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, it can't be something stupid. One guy tried to buy something new at Taco Bell, and that didn't count. But, you know, for the most part...
So they're accumulating check marks.
Accumulating check marks, and the number of check marks you have determines your grade. It was on a scale of 1 to 40, with 40 being a 4.0. So you get 3.7 if you get 37 check marks. And...
So if it was easy... So if it's easy enough if you do stuff, and if you're going at it and so on to get a perfect grade. That's the idea?
Yeah, and they determine their own grade, which is good. But I have to say, this is very, very important, that about week 10 of every 12-week quarter, there would suddenly be an insurrection in the class, and they would say, you know, you've been talking about us being self-motivating and everything else, but I got to tell you, these check marks are still sticks that you hold over.
There you go.
And it was great, because I would argue with them, except inside, I was really happy, because that was the real point. I wanted them to get to the point where they would even hate this system.
Right.
Not hate's too strong, where they would even rebel against this system.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't just give in to them, because I didn't because that was part of the lesson too, is to have them fight for the position.
Right.
And then, but I have to say, and maybe you can help me with this, is that I got really frustrated because what I found is that, for example, I didn't want to take role, but, and I said explicitly to my students that it's my job. I didn't say it's the students in prison. I said this to students at Eastern. I'll tell you why, the difference in a second. I said to my students that it's my job. Well, first off, I said to them that I could be doing anything else other than reading their papers. And so basically, I don't care what they write about. I don't care if it's fiction, nonfiction, anything. The only thing I care about is that I could be doing anything else in the entire world rather than reading their papers. So what I want is for their papers to be, for me reading their papers to be more enjoyable than sex. And then I said that the deal I'll make with you is that I will try. It's my job. I mean, I owe you every moment that you're spending in class. I owe you. It's my responsibility to make them make that interesting. So what I will do is I will try to make class more interesting than sex. And
quite a challenge.
Yeah, quite a challenge. And my point is that I would try to make class really interesting and exciting and fun. It's not so they want to be there. And that would work in general. But what I found is that every quarter, there were a few people who wouldn't show up no matter how fun I made it. And
right.
I said to one of them, do you not like class? And what can we do differently? And he said, no, but if you think I'm just going to show up without you taking role, the direct quote, you must be high. And so I found myself having to go ahead and institute a policy of taking attendance.
Right.
Because, and okay, and then the last thing, I want to say a couple things. One is that one of the reasons, the reason that I never said that when I was teaching at the prison is that a lot of my students were in there for the rest of their lives,
yeah,
and
right.
they were never again going to have sex.
Right.
So I didn't want to rub that in their faces by making
right.
that comment. So I also
right.
wouldn't say, you know, that your piece has to be better than me taking a walk through a forest, because they're never going to walk through a forest.
Mm.
I would just say, you know, your piece has to be much better than any other book I can read, or has to be better than watching television, or, you know, something.
Derek, I'm going to take a little break to tell our listeners what's going on here.
Great.
But before I do, I want to say, you know, prisoners do masturbate, I think.
Yeah, but that's not the same as sex.
All right. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to CHUO 89.1 FM, and we're having an interview today with Derek Jensen. We're talking about his work, his books, education, activism, the whole thing, but we have to take a bit of a music break right now and put on an ad to pay some bills. So we're going to do that for a minute, and then we'll be right back, Derek.
Great.
Okay.
Robert Gordon McCarg III paints faces on rocks for CHUO funding drive. I hear they really come alive.
You're here in Ottawa.
Yeah, that's me.
And you're a rock.
I'm a rock.
Okay.
I used to be inanimate, and now
yeah.
I'm just totally, you can see, I'm just alive.
You're
you know?
Alive. You're
I'm
very
just totally
alive. How did that happen?
Well, it was this artist from England just came and he just painted me, you know, and at the time I didn't even have consciousness, but this is what, you know, I didn't.
And now you're conscious.
Yeah, I got eyes, and that makes me look like I'm
okay.
looking at things, like I'm looking at you right now.
You're looking right
I'm
at
looking
me.
Right at
this
you.
This is crazy.
This is
a rock.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you have a bit of a crazy history. Like,
well, you know, before, you know, the volcanic era and all that,
yeah.
that was kind of, you know.
Bob Dylan, apparently?
Well, that was after the volcanic era. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I was just hanging out at that in Soho, right? He asked me if I wanted to play one of his tracks.
Donate $50 to CHUO during funding drive and take home a hand-painted rock signed by London underground artist Robert Gordon McCarg III.
Your rock may not talk.
Now, I did forget to say what the music break was going to be, so I'm going to come back and say that.
Uh-huh.
It's from the same album that I played while we were setting up the phone. I think you pronounce this fellow's name Mzwake Mbui, who is he's an artist from Africa. And this next song is called Ignorant, and it's a beautiful piece that relates directly to what we've been talking about.
Ignorant. I am ignorant. I am ignorant. I live in the world of fantasy. My world consists of things that I see around me. I accept everything without questioning. I am satisfied with everything, for I know nothing better.
better. I am ignorant. I am ignorant. I am ignorant. I am happy I am living. I don't worry about anything, for I know nothing better. My mental needs are food and sleep. I accept everything without reason. I take what I get, for I know not what I ought to get. I am ignorant. I am ignorant. I am ignorant. I feel fortunate in a abysmal tree of ignorance. I can read, I can write. However, how ignorant I may be, I know Mandela's enforced my presence, though I do not know why. Oh, people of Africa, help me before it's too late. Emancipate me from the chains of ignorance. Feed me with the knowledge of truth. For freedom is getting rusty on the pavements of oppression. Ignorant. I am ignorant. Ignorant.
Island Flavor Caribbean Restaurant has two locations to satisfy your island cooking cravings. Traditional jerk, delicious rotis, and yummy curries, all the Caribbean delights. If you're in the West End, try the 1018 Maryville Road location. If you're downtown, take advantage of the late night hours especially created for the 401 Dalhousie Street location. Special event catering, takeout, or eat in. You should know everything you eat at Island Flavor is made at Island Flavor. Taste it now. Call 613-321-4198.
We're back in interview with Derek Jensen. Welcome back, Derek.
Hey.
That album we just heard the song from is called Change is Pain by Mzwake. Great, great piece. I'm sorry you couldn't hear it on the other end there.
Yeah.
So we're back, and we were in the middle of talking about education, but we can go on to a different topic from your many researches, et cetera. Where do you want to go from here?
Well, actually, I wanted to finish up something about the education.
Okay.
Which is about every... Basically, the classes I taught were about, they were all about liberation. And the joke that I always used to tell myself was that if, and they were based on the notion that you can't really teach somebody else how to write. And in many ways, you can't really teach anybody else anything. The way you can do is you can create a circumstance where they want to learn. And it's like somebody said to me many, many years ago that you're not a real writer till you've written a million words. And so, basically, it was my job to cheerlead them into writing as much as possible because I can't teach them how to write. Another way about to say this is that this guy, I was at a blues concert once, and I heard somebody say to the guitarist, "Can you teach me how to play guitar?" And I said, "I can teach you everything I know in 15 minutes. Then you got to go home and practice for 15 years." And it's really the same thing for writing.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't so egotistical to think that, you know, I'm this great teacher who can give them everything. What I would do is just create the circumstance where they would learn. Because it's an extraordinary thing that school does, is to make learning a drag. When, I mean, everybody knows learning's really fun when you're learning about something you care about.
Right.
And one of my jokes that I started to say was that if any of my students had been cherished and loved just for being who they are, I would have had to get a real job.
Yeah.
Because that's all I did, really, was accept them, and they bloomed. But my point is that... every quarter I would come to the same realization, which is I would only teach the students for one quarter and then they go away and I never see them again. But it was all about liberation. But what I realized is that if I were to teach them for two quarters, the second quarter would be about responsibility. Because you can't have freedom without responsibility, and you can't have responsibility without freedom. If you have freedom without responsibility, that's just immaturity. And if you have responsibility without freedom, that's just slavery. And unfortunately, one of the things this culture does is give people toxic mimics of each one.
Right.
So they end up these people who think they're free but are actually real slaves. It's really, of course, awful. So that was one thing I wanted to say, and then something else, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. I want to contrast what you were describing about your class with something that I do in my course.
Uh-huh.
You said you wanted to be entertaining. You wanted them to want to come to class because you were making it better than sex and you were being entertaining. And I sort of take a different approach, or I wouldn't say it the same way. I want them to be in class, but I'm there, I'm real with them. I'm interacting with them, I'm challenging them, and sometimes I'm pissing them off. but we keep at it and we keep discussing and we keep doing things, you know? And some of them will leave and then they'll come back later. And they'll be really upset, or they'll have to ask themselves, why am I here? Why am I doing this? What do I really want to do? Where's my motivation? And it's very uncomfortable for them. So it's not necessarily pleasurable all the time. Of course, many of the students find it a lot of fun to be interacting in a real way like that, but others are just pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of a difference there between our stories, but
maybe it might be my misuse of the word entertainment.
Cause yeah,
entertaining, I think, is a word that has either been co-opted, you know, by sitcoms, or maybe that's what it really means, and I misspoke. That a really good example of what I'm talking about is that one of the things that I was tasked with was I was supposed to teach them, and as if you can really teach somebody to critically think. I was supposed to teach them critical thinking. And the examples we were supposed to use were things like, give them a topic. What do you think about secondhand smoke? Or, do you think that thrift shopping is fun? And those are two actual examples that were given by the department that we're supposed to use. And my God, And so what I would do is
do these topics or shoot yourself in the head.
Exactly.
Let me think. Which do I want to do?
So the topic that I end up doing that ends up being really fun is, okay, so you are at a conference and you meet somebody that, you know, instant attraction. I mean, it's like the most beautiful person you've ever seen. And you the first day you just sort of hang out and you're really, I mean, you're sitting next to the person at the conference and you're just shaking because you're so excited. And then you say, you know, so what are you doing later tonight? The person says, oh, I'm waiting for your phone call. It's like, oh, my God, did I just say that? Did that other person just say that? And then you end up spending all night talking. The next day you end up talking. You skip the conference the next day. And then you're supposed to go home the day after. And that night the person says, you know, we've been talking this whole time and just, you know, making love by talking. And I really want to bring our bodies into it. I would love to spend the night with you. I'd love to make love with you. So I stop. I say, okay, what do you do? And then people start talking about, yes, they would, no, they wouldn't. They talk about why. It's like, great. And I don't care, of course, the answer. I couldn't care less what they do. And then, and that was another rule in the class, is that you can't judge other people. I mean, nobody would ever say that a woman was a slut because she said yes, or the guy's a wimp because he says no. That was absolutely disallowed. But in any case, they're having this conversation. Okay, stop. Okay, what if you're having these great conversations, but you're in a relationship back home that's not very good? What do you do now? Okay, well, what about, you know, we talk about that.
Right.
And one person I remember said, I tell a person, I'm going to make a quick phone call, I'll be right back. And I said, okay, let's change the circumstance again.
Yeah.
And what about if you know, the person's really, you're having this wonderful conversation, but the person is physically, I mean, they're not Quasimodo, but, you know, like three-quarters of the way there? What do you do then? And it was so cool because I would get calls the next day from people in their dorm saying, can I add your class? Because they'd gone home and they were talking about this until 4 and 5 in the morning.
Right.
And what they didn't know is that it just made me laugh every time, because the purpose wasn't sex. The purpose was decision trees. And the purpose is defending your position. And my whole point, that's what I really meant by making it entertaining. I probably chose the wrong word for that, is make it something that they want to talk about.
Right.
And that they care about. And if you find something that they care about, and one thing I didn't care, I mean, it could be sex one day, it could be, there was one student I had once who carried a picture of Ronald Reagan around in his pocket. And so different you know, we and there was another student in the same class who had had a party the day that Ronald Reagan got shot. And so, you know, let's talk about that.
Right.
What do you think? What do you think about, right. Do you think Ronald Reagan should have been shot?
Right.
And, you know, just enter a lively discussion with the understanding also that the point is not to specific, it's not a debate club where you're trying to convince the other people. Instead, it's an attempt. We would all recognize all the time that the purpose is to hone your own and the other person's arguments.
Yes.
And so it's kind of like when I was a teenager, I had some boxing gloves. And I used to spar with friends. I never did it officially or anything. And the point wasn't to beat the other person up. The point is just to get better.
Yes.
And we all recognize that. Anyway, does that make more sense?
It does, yeah, sure. The reason I threw that in is just to continue this conversation and compare notes, right?
Uh-huh.
The one thing you said though was this idea that you couldn't, I don't know if I got it right, the right words, but you couldn't criticize the other person or you couldn't judge the other person. Did you say something to that effect, that was an absolute rule in the class?
It was very important that, you can disagree,
uh-huh.
but it's very important that people, if you're going to get people to be honest and say, one of the examples with the whole sex thing. I remember this one woman say she held her hand out, or she put her hand out with her third finger out and with her thumb on her third finger, and said, "Not without a ring." And there were people who really disagreed with that, but they weren't allowed to say, "Oh God, that's stupid."
Right.
Because that's gonna make it so she doesn't ever want to say anything, and they can say
right. But you know, did you have for example, would you have a situation where the person would say that is stupid, and then you'd have to have a discussion about how appropriate it was to say that and to make that judgment and to attack the person in that way, or did you just try to have this absolute rule that you enforced from the beginning?
I would set it up from the beginning, and there were. For the most part, people got into it pretty quickly, and mm-hmm. they recognized that you don't say something that's going to... I mean, you don't say something that's insulting.
Right.
But there were a few students who never got that. I remember one student who was a fundamentalist Christian who never got it. And late in the quarter, one guy, American Indian, people were talking about their perception of God, whether they don't believe in a God at all, whether God is evident in, you know, this huckleberry plant that I'm seeing right here, whether God's a guy with a big beard, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. Whether God's a process, I don't care, there's whatever. And this one guy said he's American Indian, and Colville Indian, and this one fundamentalist Christian said, "Oh, that means you believe in ghosts, right?" And everybody in the class just sort of froze, because it's a really kind of insulting way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just said, yeah, I guess it means that. And then we're on to the next person.
Yeah, unlike the God of Christianity, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And my point is that she pretty consistently said some very clueless and often insulting things.
Right.
But since we all knew, it was... I mean, it's like having, you know, it's having the sort of uncle who will burst out with racist things at a gathering, and you just, you know, you've said something to him about 50 times and
right.
you can't stop him from telling racist jokes. And so it's like, you know, Uncle Joe's going to do this, and I've said my piece 50 times, now I just have to ignore him.
Right. Right. Well, David Noble likes to say that professors at university with freshmen would, you know, one of the first things you'd tell them is, if you believe in God, you'll believe anything. And it was like the first shock of coming to university, you know.
That's great.
But now it's the opposite. I mean, religion is coming back onto campuses in a big way, and there are all these ideological battles going on and so on. It's a horrible situation.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, and there's that religion, and then, of course, also, I don't know if we want to go this direction, too, but those who don't believe in the religion of Christianity believe in the religion of science.
Yes.
And that's just...
Yes.
That one's even worse in some ways, because if you don't believe in God, then you're going to go to hell after you die, which you don't believe in anyway. But if you don't believe in science, then you must be just plain stupid.
Right, right. Well, any authority will do, right? Let's just
right.
have an authority out there. Yeah. Endgame talks about hope. Do you want to tell us about Hope? Because I know you've got some really striking comments to make about Hope. That I remember reading that essay, that is, I think, from the book Endgame on the internet, and it's beautiful. It's so important to hear that, and it relates to these ideas in the book Pacifism as Pathology, for which you wrote an introduction to that essay by Ward Churchill in the latest edition. So I think I'd like us to go there for the last minutes, if you would like. Yeah.
Well, Hope, very briefly, is. You know, a lot of people say, "Oh gosh, we need hope. We have to have hope." But I was bashing hope at a talk I did in Colorado several years ago, and somebody in the audience shouted out. Well, first off, I want to separate. There's false hope and real hope.
Mm.
And false hopes are one of the reasons my mother stayed with my father. He was extremely violent. One of the reasons she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. And false hopes are promulgated intentionally all the time by the system, by oppressors, to get people to stay in line, whether that false hope is, you know, pie in the sky when you die, or whether it's some future technotopia, or whether it's, you know, the American dream, or whether it's the belief that warehouses will stop defaulting because we ask nicely, you know, whether it's the legal system, you know, we can all list. I mean, so many of my students at the prison had the false hopes that, you know, if my appeal is just going to get me out.
Right.
And that, by the way, I didn't blame them, and of course I didn't puncture those at all, because they are honest to goodness powerless in their circumstances.
Yeah.
And if somebody honest to goodness is powerless, man, you don't take away the false hope.
Right, right.
But if they actually have agency, then we need to ruthlessly eradicate those false hopes.
Yeah.
Because false hopes blind us to real possibilities. They can keep us bound to this unlovable self. That's the purpose of them.
Uh-huh.
Those are false hopes. But then I was bashing hope gleefully at this talk I did several years ago, and someone in the audience shouted out, "What's your definition of hope?" And I was like, "Oh shoot, I don't know. I've just been bashing. I have no idea what I'm talking about." And I said, "What? You give me a definition." And the definition they came up with is great, which is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. That's how we use it in everyday language.
That is brilliant, because it fits exactly into the critique that you make about it, right? You say it's useless. If that's what it is, it's useless.
Yeah, it's useless.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, it's the logic of addiction, really. I read somewhere the definition of addiction, or an example. There's a book on addiction, and the guy started off the book with, you got some guy sitting on his couch eating chocolate-covered raisins and complaining that his plants are all dying of thirst, when he has a pitcher that he could go over and get water with, but he doesn't do that. He sits on the couch and complains and says he, you know, hopes the plants get watered. And that's kind of it. You know, it's, I don't hope that I eat something today. I'm just going to do it. On the other hand, the next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash, because once I'm in the air, I have no agency. And so, years ago, this friend of mine was saying, so does this mean her brother was dying of cancer? And I said, does this mean I can't say that I hope my brother lives? I said, no, of course you can, because that's out of your control. What I'm trying to get at is to figure out what you can and can't control. And I said, no, you have no agency. The cancer may kill him or may not. But on the other hand, if he says, I have to go to the hospital, and you're standing there with car keys in your hand and your car's outside, and you say, I hope you make it to the hospital, that's reprehensible.
But, Derek, okay, this is CHUO 89.1 FM, and we're having an interview with Derek Jensen all the way from California, here in Ottawa, on the campus of the University of Ottawa. Derek, how does this idea of hope relate to this saying, you know, pessimism of the mind, optimism of the will? You know, you're being realistic, you're pessimistic, we'll never get out of this, but at the same time, you act, and you are an activist, and so you're optimistic that you will have an effect, even though your brain tells you there's not much chance. Does it relate in does it fit into your critique of hope?
Well, like I believe you said a couple minutes ago, I think hope's kind of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And I do what I do because I'm in love. I love the salmon, and if you love the salmon, if you love anybody, you know, then you do what's appropriate.
Well, they're being killed.
Right. So I do what's necessary to stop them from being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I can hope that things that are out of my control go right, but there are plenty of things I can control. And I think it's really important to figure out what you can. And so far as optimism, and pessimism. I don't so much disagree with that statement you said, as so much as I don't really think about it in terms of, I just look at what needs to be done and then let's do it.
You're saving your family, you're saving your community, you're saving the salmon, you're saving the organisms that are worth saving on the planet.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're plowing ahead with that.
Yeah, exactly. And also it has to do with knowing that you can't, I also want to be on the winning side, and the natural world can ultimately win, no matter if it's an expensive, bloody battle, because you can't fight the natural world and win. The natural world's way bigger and more complex and smarter than we are,
mm-hmm.
and especially smarter than capitalists are.
Right.
And so it's just, it's really, that's one of the things, too, this arrogance, thinking that we have to do all the work, when the truth is that the salmon and the redwood trees and the chickadees and the whippoorwills and the bobwhites, and they're already doing most of the work. All we have to do is align ourselves with them.
Right. All right, let's move on to pacifism as pathology.
Uh-huh.
What's that about? What's the critique there? What was your contribution to those ideas, and how do you use it in your own activism?
About pacifism?
Yeah, pacifism as pathology.
Well, a couple of things. One is that pacifism really is, I have to say, I have no problem with pacifism as such. The problem I have is with dogma. I've got some very good friends. I've shared the stage with friends who are pacifists who recognize, and one of the great things about everything being so messed up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. And there's wonderful work can be done by people that's purely above ground, that's purely, that doesn't cause them to fight back. But the important thing is that we need to respect each other's work. And what I've encountered from a lot of dogmatic pacifists, once again with Key on dogmatic, is that an absolute refusal to allow anyone else to even talk about anything that they don't want to do. And one of the jokes I've been making is that I'm going to put out another book called Endgame for Pacifists. And that book's going to be 1,000 blank pages and one page in the middle that says sometimes it's okay to fight back, because that's the only message they hear from that 1,100 pages. And it's, and part of the problem is that we need to recognize that those in power rule by force, and the only thing they care about is force. And the only thing that will stop them is force. And you can have 7 million people, 15 million people march. Well, there were 15 million people marched against the Iraq war, and it didn't do any good. But you can have, you can assemble that nonviolent force if you can get enough people. And if you can't get enough people, then you have to start thinking about leverage. And that's what I'm really interested in.
Yeah, but
what are the levers?
For purely pacifist movements, how many people is enough people?
I'm sorry?
For purely pacifist movements, how many people is enough people? What is this magical critical mass? You know, how much is enough? Has a pacifist critical mass actually changed something?
Oh, see there. Okay, this is great. Because years ago, I was reading, a publisher sent me a book that they had received, and they were wondering whether they should publish it.
Right.
And so they sent it to me, and it was by, I don't want to say who it was by, it was a famous pacifist, and he had this line in there that made me so angry. He said that the anti-Vietnam War movement was the greatest success of any nonviolent resistance anywhere that's ever happened.
Right.
And I got so mad, and, I called a person a racist, all sorts of words we're not supposed to say on the radio, and I threw the book across the room, because, of course, he was ignoring the millions of Vietnamese who fought and killed and died.
Yes.
And so, people throw Gandhi out a lot, but what they always ignore is, well, they ignore many things, one of which was that Gandhi is pretty much hated by a lot of the Indian activists that I know, the Indian activists, because he co-opted real revolutionary spirit. They also ignore the fact that there were Sikhs with guns. And they also ignore the fact that the British Empire is blood white, and they also ignore the fact that Gandhi didn't win, that Coca-Cola won. Ultimately the corporations won.
And also the British Empire was greatly weakened violence against it through the two world wars and so on. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or they throw out the Danish resistance in World War II, which was almost exclusively nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
And what they ignore is that the only reason that that worked is because Hitler was very fond of Denmark and had set up Denmark as a, quote, model protectorate. And if, you know, they talk about the king putting on a silver star or a gold star for the, or yellow star, I'm sorry, yellow star for when the Jews were supposed to, the king was the first one to do it. Shoot, you know, if somebody in Poland would have done that, they would have said, great, get on the cattle car with the rest of them. And
yeah.
So what's really important, and one of the things I hate about pacifism is that it values external dogma over direct circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if you're in Denmark, then maybe it's appropriate to do it that way. If you're in Poland, you got to do it it may be appropriate to do it a different way. And
Hold that thought.
Sorry, go ahead.
I have to get one more ad in, and
okay.
I'm doing it right now. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Okay, great.
The Garlic Corner on Dalhousie in New York has all your Lebanese delights. Shawarma, shish kebabs, barbecue, and sandwiches so big they're monsters. Open from 7 a.m. to 4 a.m. every day means they're an option for more than the after-party late-night fix. Try it for lunch for a change. Grape leaf rolls, fattoush, tabbouleh, they have all the famous salads. Maybe you crave an afterward shisha. The fully licensed Garlic Corner is your place. Whatever your reason to go, mention that you heard this ad on CHUO. The Garlic Corner on Dalhousie in New York.
Okay, the 5 o'clock train is in interview with Derek Jensen all the way from California, and we're back, and we cut you in that enthralling speech about pacifism, and we've got just a few minutes left in the hour, so how do we wrap this up?
Well, I think the important thing, I had this horrible interview with the pacifist magazine. It was terrible. The guy misconstrued everything I said, et cetera, which is really typical of discourse with dogmatic pacifists, just like any fundamentalist. Anyway, the point is that ultimately we have to remember that a movement is a means to an end. And those people who come after are not going to care about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care about whether we were pacifists, not pacifists. They're not going to care how hard we tried. They're not going to care about how we taught in classes. They're not going to care about whether we wrote books. They're not going to care about whether we did radio interviews. They're not going to care about any of that stuff. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and breathe the air. And that's the bottom line. We forget that so often, that so often people think, oh, I did my part. I went and got arrested or whatever. It's like, okay, did you actually accomplish anything in the real physical world? We forget that the point is not to get arrested or not get arrested. The point is not to write really good books or not write really good books. The point is to...
And the point is also not to just change the rules locally in our very privileged first world societies either.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Okay.
The point of being an activist, as my friend Lee Ortiz says, is not to manifest any sort of purity. The point is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. And that's what we really need to do. And how we do that is entirely dependent upon gifts, skills, circumstances. But the important thing is, we need to do it. It must be done.
Derek Jensen, are you an anarchist?
And you know, I get called that a lot.
You've got 1 minute here.
I'm sorry, what?
You've got 1 minute.
Okay. It's kind of like the line from the book, The Virginian, when somebody insults the Virginian or something, he says, smile when you say that. So if somebody's smiling when they say, are you an anarchist? I say, yes. And if they say, oh, are you one of those darn anarchists?
I'm smiling. Ear to ear.
Sure. Yeah. The reason I'm laughing about this is because, yes, I self-identify as an anarchist a lot of times, but then there was a review of one of my books in some anarchist magazine one time that said I wasn't enough of an anarchist.
Right.
And that just made me laugh and laugh and laugh. I didn't know that was possible.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a complex discussion that you and I could have sometime about, there's much about anarchism I really like, and there is some stuff that I'm troubled by.
Uh-huh.
And there's some great, I've been having a long conversation with John Zerzan, 10 years now, about whether resistance should be hierarchical or non-hierarchical. It's a wonderful conversation we've been having for a long time.
We have to go. Can we get you back here to talk about anarchism?
That'd be great.
Because Paulo Freire, I believe, is an anarchist, and he's got these ideas on how you make revolution without just putting in another power structure that will then oppress.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're it's an anarchist idea. And so there's a lot to talk about, as you say there. Can we have you back for that?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
It's been wonderful having you on the show. Thank you so much
really
for agreeing to do this. Goodbye.
You're a great interviewer.
Okay, thank you very much. And we'll do this again.
Yep.
Bye now.
Okay, bye.
The train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming down. I said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming down.
So long I've been waiting, waiting for you. Oh yeah. Now the time has come when it's between me and you. The train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now, 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 now. I said the train is coming, baby. And I am leaving on that train, Lord.
I said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now. I said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now.
Every day I pray for this little hour. Mm-hmm. Now the time has come, and I want you to stand by me. Because the train is coming, baby, and we are leaving on the train. And we will roam this land where we all will be free, Lord.
I said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now. I said the train is coming, baby. I said the train is coming now.